My hand feels cold without his. I pull out my phone and say, "We need to document this somehow." I start taking pictures before he nods okay, and we take turns posing on the high point. Then he gets the map out of his backpack, along with a college-ruled notebook. He hands me the notebook and a pen, and when I say, "That's okay," he tells me his handwriting is like chicken scratch, and it's up to me to keep the notes. The thing I can't say is I'd rather drive all the way to Indianapolis than write in this notebook. But because he's watching me, I scrawl down a few things. Location, date, time, a brief description of the place itself and the kids by the fence. And afterward, we spread the map out on the picnic table. Finch traces the red highway lines with his index finger.
"I know Black mentioned picking two wonders and running with them, but I don't think that's enough. I think we need to see all of them."
"All of what?"
"Every place of interest in the state. As many as we can cram into the semester."
"Only two. That's the deal." He studies the map, shakes his head. His hand moves over the paper. By the time he's done, he's made pen marks across the entire state, circling every town he knows of where there's a wonder. Dune State Park, the world's largest egg, home of Dan Patch the racehorse, the Market Street Catacombs, and the Seven Pillars, which are a series of enormous limestone columns carved by Nietzsche that overlook the Mississinewa River. Some of the circles are close to Bartlett, some are far away.
"That's too many," I say.
"Maybe. Maybe not."
Early evening. Finch's driveway. I stand with Leroy as Finch shoves his bike into the garage. He opens the door to go inside, and when I don't move, he says,
"We have to get your bag."
"I'll wait here." He just laughs and goes away. While he's gone, I text my mom to tell her I'll be heading home soon. I picture her waiting at the window, watching for me, even though she would never let me catch her at it. In a few minutes, Finch is back, and standing too close, looking down at me with blue, blue eyes. With one hand, he brushes the hair out of them. It's been a long time since I've been this close to a boy other than Ryan. And I suddenly remember what Sue said about Finch knowing what to do with a girl. Theodore, freak or no freak, he is lean and good-looking and trouble. Like that, I feel myself pulling back in. I drop Eleanor's glasses onto my face so that Finch looks warped and strange, like I'm seeing him in a funhouse mirror.
"Because you smiled at me."
"What?"
"You asked why I wanted to do this with you. It's not because you were up on the ledge, too. Even though, okay, that's part of it. It's not because I feel this weird responsibility to keep an eye on you, which is also part of it. It's because you smiled at me that day in class. A real smile. Not the bullshit one I see you give everyone all the time where your eyes are doing one thing and your mouth is doing another."
"It was just a smile."
"Maybe to you."
"You know I'm going out with Ryan Cross."
"I thought you said he wasn't your boyfriend."
Before I can recover, he laughs.
"Relax. I don't like you like that."
Dinner time. My house. My father makes chicken piccata, which means the kitchen is a mess. I set the table as Mom ties her hair back and takes the plates from Dad. In my house, eating is an event accompanied by the right music and the right wine. My mom takes a bite of chicken, gives my dad a thumbs up, and looks at me.
"So, tell me more about this project."
"We're supposed to wander Indiana, as if there's anything interesting to see. We have to have partners, so
I'm working with this boy in my class. My dad raises an eyebrow at my mother, and then me.
You know, I was terrific at geography back in the day. If you need any help with that project.
Mom and I cut him off at the same time, telling him how good the food is, asking if we can have more. He gets up, pleased and distracted, and my mother mouths to me, "Close one." My dad lives to help with school projects. The problem is, he ends up taking them over completely. He comes back in saying,
"So, this project..."
Just as my mom is saying,
"So, this boy..."
Except for wanting to know my every move, my parents act pretty much like they always did. It throws me when they're the parents of before, because nothing about me is like it used to be. "Dad, I was just wondering," I begin, my mouth full of chicken. "Where did this dish begin? I mean, how did they come up with it?" If there's anything my dad likes more than projects, it's explaining the history of things. For the rest of the meal, he talks nonstop about ancient Italy and the Italians' love for clean, simple cooking, which means my project and this boy are forgotten. Upstairs, I scroll around Finch's Facebook page. I'm still his only friend. Suddenly, a new message appears.
"I feel like I just walked through the back of the wardrobe and into Narnia."
I immediately research Narnia quotes. The one that stands out is, "I have come home at last. This is my real country. I belong here. This is the land I have been looking for all my life, though I never knew it till now. Come further up. Come further in." But instead of copying it down and sending it, I get up and mark the day off on the calendar. I stand looking at the word graduation all the way in June as I think about Hoosier Hill, Finch's blue eyes, and the way he made me feel. Like everything else that doesn't last, today is gone now. But it was a pretty good day. The best I've had in months.
Finch. The night of the day my life changed. My mother stares at me over her plate. Decca, as usual, is eating like a small, ravenous horse, and for once I'm doing my share of shoveling it in. Mom says, "Decca, tell me what you learned today." Before she can answer, I say, "Actually, I'd like to go first." Deck stops eating long enough to gape at me, her mouth full of partially chewed casserole. Mom smiles nervously and holds onto her glass and plate, as if I might get up and start throwing things. "Of course, Theodore. Tell me what you learned." "I learned that there is good in this world, if you look hard enough for it. I learned that not everyone is disappointing, including me, and that a 1,257-foot bump in the ground can feel higher than a bell tower if you're standing next to the right person." Mom waits politely, and when I don't say anything else, she starts nodding. "This is great. That's really good, Theodore. Isn't that interesting, Decca?" As we clear the plates, my mother looks as dazed and disconcerted as she always does, only more so because she doesn't have the first clue what to do with my sisters and me. Since I feel happy about my day and also bad for her because my father not only broke her heart, he pretty much shat all over her pride and self-worth, I tell her, "Mom, why don't you let me do the dishes tonight? You should put your feet up." When my dad left us this last and final time, my mom earned her realtor's license, but because the housing market is less than booming, she part-times at a bookstore. She is always tired. Her face crumples, and for one awful moment, I'm afraid she's going to cry. But then she kisses me on the cheek and says, "Thank you," in such a world-weary way that I almost want to cry myself, except that I'm feeling much too good for that. Then she says, Did you just call me Mum? I'm putting on my shoes at the very moment the sky opens up and it starts to pour. By the looks of it, we're talking cold, blinding sleet, so instead of going out for a run, I take a bath. I strip, climb in, water splashing onto the floor, leaving little pools that shake like beached fish. The whole operation doesn't work well at first because I am twice as long as the bathtub, but the tub is full of water and I've come this far, and I have to see it through. My feet rest halfway up the tile of the wall as I go under, eyes open, staring up at the showerhead and the black curtain and plastic liner in the ceiling, and then I close my eyes and pretend I'm in a lake. Water is peaceful. I am at rest. In the water, I am safe and pulled in where I can't get out. Everything slows down, the noise and the racing of my thoughts. I wonder if I could sleep like this, here on the bottom of the bathtub, if I wanted to sleep, which I don't. I let my mind drift. I hear words forming as if I'm sitting at the computer already. In March of 1941, after three serious breakdowns, Virginia Woolf wrote a note to her husband and walked to a nearby river. She shoved heavy stones into her pocket and dove into the water. "Dearest," the note began, "I feel certain that I am going mad again. I feel we can't go through another of those terrible times. So I am doing what seems the best thing to do." How long has it been? 4 minutes? 5? Longer? My lungs are starting to burn. "Stay calm," I tell myself. "Stay relaxed. The worst thing you can do is panic." 6 minutes? 7? The longest I've held my breath is 6.5 minutes. The world record is 22 minutes and 22 seconds, and this belongs to a German competitive breath holder. He says it's all about control and endurance, but I suspect it has more to do with the fact that his lung capacity is 20% larger than the average person's. I wonder if there's something to this competitive breath holding, if there's really a living to be made at it. "You have been in every way all that anyone could be. If anybody could have saved me, it would have been you." I open my eyes and sit straight up, gasping, filling my lungs. I'm happy no one's here to see me, because I'm sputtering and splashing and coughing up water. There's no rush of having survived, only emptiness and lungs that need air and wet hair sticking to my face.
Violet. 148 days till graduation. Thursday. U.S. Geography. The Bartlett Dirt has named the top 10 suicidal students in school, and my phone is buzzing because Theodore Finch is number 1 on the list. Jordan Grippenwalt has covered the front page of the school paper with resources and information about teen suicide and what to do if you're thinking of killing yourself. But no one is paying attention to this. I turn off my phone and put it away. To distract myself and him, I ask Ryan about the Wander Indiana project. He is partners with Joe Wyatt. Their theme is baseball. They're planning to visit the County Baseball Museum and the Indiana Baseball Hall of Fame in Jasper. "That sounds really great," I say. He's playing with my hair, and to make him stop, I lean over and pretend to search for something in my bag. For their wanderings, Amanda and Romer are planning to focus on the James Whitcomb Riley Museum and our local farm and history museum, which is right here in Bartlett, and features an actual Egyptian mummy. I can't think of anything more depressing than to be an Egyptian high priest on display next to a set of vintage wagon wheels and a two-headed chicken.
Amanda examines the ends of her ponytail. She is the only person besides me who is ignoring her phone.
So, how is it? Is it awful?
She stops examining long enough to look at me.
What?
Finch? I shrug.
It's okay.
Oh my God! You like him!
No, I don't.
But I can feel my face turning pink because everyone is looking at me. Amanda has such a loud mouth. Thankfully, the bell rings and Mr. Black wants eyes on him, people. At some point, Ryan slips me a note because my phone is off. I see it under his arm, waving at me, and I take it.
Drive-in double feature Saturday night? Just you and me?
I write, "Can I let you know?" I tap Ryan's arm and hand him the note. Mr. Black walks to the chalkboard and writes, "Pop quiz," and then a list of questions. Everybody groans and there's the sound of ripping paper. 5 minutes later, Finch breezes in, same black shirt, same black jeans, backpack over one shoulder, books and notebooks and thrashed leather jacket under his arm. Things are spilling everywhere, and he retrieves keys and pens and cigarettes before giving Mr. Black a little salute. I look at him and think, this is the person who knows your worst secret. Finch pauses to read the board.
Pop quiz. Sorry, sir. Just a second.
He's using his Australian accent. Before he takes his seat, he heads right for me. He sets something on my notebook. He slaps Ryan on the back, drops an apple on the teacher's desk with another apology to Mr. Black, and falls into his chair across the room. The thing he set in front of me is an ugly gray rock. Ryan looks down at it and up at me, and then past me at Romer, who narrows his eyes in Finch's direction.
Freak,
he says loudly. He mimes hanging himself. Amanda punches me a little too hard in the arm.
Let me see it.
Mr. Black raps on the desk.
In 5 more seconds, I will give each and every one of you an F on this quiz.
He picks up the apple and looks as if he's going to throw it. We all go quiet. He sets the apple down. Ryan turns around, and now I can see the freckles on the base of his neck. The quiz is made up of 5 easy questions. After Mr. Black collects the papers and starts to lecture, I pick up the rock and flip it over. Your turn, it says. After class, Finch is out the door before I can talk to him. I drop the rock into my bag. Ryan walks me to Spanish, and we don't hold hands.
So, what's up with that? Why is he giving you things? Is it, what, a thank you for saving his life?
It's a rock. If it was a thank you for saving him, I'd hope for something a little better than that.
I don't care what it is.
Don't be that guy, Ryan.
What guy?
As we walk, he nods at people going by, everyone smiling and calling out, "Hey, Ryan, what's up, Cross?" They do everything but bow and throw confetti. A few of them are good enough to call out to me, too, now that I'm a hero. The guy who's jealous of the guy his ex-girlfriend's doing a project with?
I'm not jealous.
We stop outside my classroom.
I'm just crazy about you. And I think we should get back together.
I don't know if I'm ready.
I'm going to keep asking.
I guess I can't stop you.
If he gets out of line, let me know.
The corner of his mouth goes up. When he smiles like that, there's a single dimple. It was the thing that got me the very first time I saw him. Without thinking, I reach up and kiss the dimple, when what I mean to do is kiss his cheek. I don't know which of us is more surprised. I say, You don't need to worry. It's only a project. At dinner that night, the thing I fear most happens. My mom turns to me and asks,
"Were you in the bell tower of school last week?"
She and my dad are staring at me from opposite ends of the table. I immediately choke on my food, so noisily and violently that my mother gets up to pat me on the back. My dad says,
"Too spicy?"
"No, Dad, it's great." I barely get the words out because I'm still coughing. I cover my mouth with my napkin and cough like some tubercular old uncle. Mom pats me until I quiet down and then takes her seat again.
"I got a call from a reporter at the local paper who wants to do a story on our heroic daughter. Why didn't you tell us?"
"I don't know. They're making a bigger deal of it than it is. I'm not a hero. I just happened to be up there. I don't think he really would have jumped." I drink my entire glass of water because my mouth is suddenly dry.
"Who's this boy you saved?"
my dad wants to know. "He's just a boy I go to school with. He's okay now." My mother and father glance at each other, and in that one shared look, I can see what they're thinking. Our daughter isn't as hopelessly lost as we thought. They will start expecting things, beginning with a newer, braver Violet who isn't afraid of her own shadow. Mom picks up her fork again.
"The reporter left her name and number and asked that you call her when you have a chance."
"Great," I say. "Thanks, I will."
"By the way," my mom's voice turns casual, but there's something in it that makes me want to hurry and finish so I can get out of there fast. "How does New York sound for spring break? We haven't taken a family trip in a while."
"We haven't taken one since before the accident. This would be our first trip without Eleanor. But then, there have been lots of firsts. First Thanksgiving, first Christmas, first New Year's Eve. This is the first calendar year of my life that she hasn't been in."
"We can take in some shows, do a little shopping. We can always stop by NYU and see if there are any interesting lectures."
She smiles too brightly. Even worse, my dad is smiling too. "It sounds great," I say. But we all know I don't mean it. That night, I have the same nightmare I've been having for months. The one where someone comes at me from behind and tries to strangle me. I feel the hands on my throat, pressing tighter and tighter, but I can't see who's doing it. Sometimes the person doesn't get as far as touching me, but I know he's there. Other times, I can feel the breath going out of me. My head goes light, my body floats away, and I start to fall. I wake up, and for a few seconds, I don't know where I am. I sit up and turn on a light and look around my room, as if the man might be lurking behind the desk or in the closet. I reach for my laptop. In the days before, I would have written something, a short story or a blog post or just random thoughts. I would have written till it was out of me and on the page. But now I open a new document and stare at the screen. I write a couple words, erase them, write, erase. I was the writer, not Eleanor. But there is something about the act of writing that makes me feel as if I'm cheating on her. Maybe because I'm here and she's not. And the whole thing, every big or small moment I've lived since last April, feels like cheating in some way. Finally, I sign on to Facebook. There's a new message from Finch, 1:04 a.m.
"Did you know the world's tallest woman and one of the world's tallest men were from Indiana? What does that say about our state?"
I check the current time, 1:44 a.m. I write, We have greater nutritional resources than other states. I watch the page, the house quiet around me. I tell myself he's probably asleep by now, that it's just me who's awake. I should read or turn out the light and try to get some rest before I have to get up for school. Finch writes,
"Also the world's largest man. I'm worried that our nutritional resources are actually damaged. Maybe this is one reason I'm so tall. What if I don't stop growing? Will you want me just as much when I'm 15 feet 9 inches?
Me. How can I want you then when I don't want you now? Finch.
Give it time. The thing I'm most concerned with is how I'm going to ride a bike. I don't think they make them that big.
Me. Look on the bright side. Your legs will be so long that one of your steps will be the same as 30 or 40 of a regular person's. Finch.
So you're saying I can carry you when we wander?
Me. Yes.
Finch. After all, you're famous.
Me. You're the hero, not me.
Finch. Believe me, I'm no hero. What are you doing up, anyway?
Me. Bad dreams. Finch.
Regular occurrence?
Me. More than I'd like. Finch.
Since the accident? Or before?
Me. Since. You?
Finch. Too much to do and write and think. Besides, who would keep you company?
I want to say I'm sorry about the Bartlett dirt. No one really believes the lies they print. It'll all die down eventually. But then he writes,
"Meet me at the quarry."
Me. I can't. Finch.
Don't keep me waiting. On second thought, I'll meet you at your house.
Me. I can't. No answer. Me. Finch?
Finch. Day 13. I throw rocks at her window, but she doesn't come down. I think about ringing the doorbell, but that would only wake the parents. I try waiting her out, but the curtain doesn't move, and the door doesn't open, and it is really fucking cold. So finally I climb into Little Bastard and go home. I'm up the rest of the night making a list called How to Stay Awake. There's the obvious, Red Bull, caffeine, no doze, and other drugs. But this isn't about skipping a couple hours sleep. It's about staying up and staying here for the long haul. 1. Run. 2. Write. This includes any thoughts I don't want to have. Write them out fast so they're out of me and on the paper. 3. Along those lines, accept any and all thoughts. Don't be afraid of them, no matter what they are. 4. Surround myself with water. 5. Plan. 6. Drive anywhere and everywhere, even when there's nowhere to go. Note, there's always somewhere to go. 7. Play guitar. 8. Organize room, notes, thoughts. This is different from planning. 9. Do whatever it takes to remind myself that I'm still here and have a say. 10. Violet.
Violet. 147 to 146 days till freedom. The next morning, my house. I walk out the door to find Finch lying on the front lawn, eyes closed, black boots crossed at the ankle. His bike rests on its side, half in and half off the street. I kick the sole of his shoe. "Were you out here all night?" He opens his eyes.
"So you did know I was here.
Hard to tell when a person's being ignored while standing, I may add, in the freezing Arctic cold.
He pulls himself to his feet, shoulders his backpack, picks up his bike.
Any more nightmares?
No. Will I get Leroy from the garage? Finch rides up and down the driveway.
So where are we headed?
School.
I mean tomorrow, when we wander. Unless you've got big plans.
He says this as if he knows I don't. I think about Ryan and the drive-in. I still haven't told him yes or no. I'm not sure I'm free tomorrow. We push off toward school. Finch sprinting forward, doubling back. Sprinting forward, doubling back. The ride is almost peaceful until he says,
I was thinking that, as your partner and the guy who saved your life, I should know what happened the night of the accident.
Leroy wobbles, and Finch reaches out and steadies the bike and me. The electric current starts shooting through me just like before, and there goes my balance again. We ride for a minute with his hand on the back of the seat. I keep my eyes open for Amanda or Suze because I know exactly how this will look.
So, what happened?
I hate the way he brings up the accident just like that, like it's okay to talk about.
I'll tell you how I got my scar if you tell me about that night.
Why do you want to know?
Because I like you. Not in a romantic let's get it on way, but as a fellow student of U.S. geography. And because it might help you to talk about it.
You first.
I was playing this show over in Chicago with these guys I met at a bar. They were like, hey man, our guitar player just walked out, and you look like you know your way around a stage. I got up there, no clue what I was doing, what they were doing, but we threw it down. I mean, threw it down. I was hotter than Hendrix. They knew it, and the original guitar player knew it. So the son of a bitch climbed up after me and cut me open with his guitar pick.
Did that really happen? The school's in sight. Kids are getting out of their cars and hanging around on the lawn.
There may also have been a girl involved.
I can't tell by the look on his face if he's bullshitting me or not, but I'm pretty sure he is.
Your turn.
Only after you tell me what really happened. I take off and fly toward the parking lot and the bike rack. When I come to a stop, Finch is right behind me, laughing his head off. In my pocket, my phone is buzzing and buzzing. I pull it out, and there are 5 texts from Suze, all with the same message. Theodore Freak? WTF? I look around, but she isn't anywhere.
See you tomorrow, he's saying.
Actually, I've got plans. He glances at my phone, and then at me, giving me a look that's hard to read.
All right. That's cool. Later then, Ultraviolet.
What did you call me?
You heard me.
School's that way. I point toward the building.
I know.
And away he goes, in the other direction. Saturday. My house. I am on the phone with Jerry Sparks, the reporter from the local paper who wants to send someone out to take my picture. She says, how does it feel to know you've saved someone's life? I know, of course, about the terrible tragedy you suffered last year. Does this in any way give you closure? How would this give me closure? The fact that you couldn't save your sister's life, but you were able to save the life of this boy, Theodore Finch. I hang up on her, as if they are one and the same. And besides, I'm not the one who saved a life. Finch is the hero, not me. I'm just a girl pretending to be a hero. I am still seething by the time Ryan shows up, 5 minutes early. We walk to the drive-in because it's only a mile from my house. I keep my hands in the pockets of my coat, but we walk with our arms bumping. It's like a first date all over again. At the drive-in, we find Amanda and Romer, who are parked in Romer's car. He drives an enormous old Chevy Impala, which is as large as a city block. He calls it the party car because it can fit about 65 people at once. Ryan opens the back door for me, and I get in. Because the Impala is parked, I'm fine being in there, even though it smells like smoke and old fast food and, faintly, of pot. I'm probably incurring years of secondhand smoke damage just sitting here. The movie is a Japanese monster movie double feature, and before it starts, Ryan, Romer, and Amanda talk about how awesome college will be. They're all going to Indiana University. I sit thinking about Jerry Sparks and New York and spring break, and how bad I feel about blowing off Finch and for being rude to him when he saved my life. Wandering with him would be more fun than this. Anything would be more fun than this. The car is hot and fumy, even though the windows are open. And when the second movie starts, Romer and Amanda lie down flat in the enormous front seat and go almost completely quiet. Almost. Every now and then I hear a slurping, smacking sound, as if they're two hungry dogs lapping at the food bowl. I try watching the movie. And when that doesn't work, I try writing the scene in my mind. Amanda's head pops up over the seat, her shirt hanging open so that I can see her bra, which is baby blue with yellow flowers. Like that, I can feel the image burning into my retinas, where it will remain forever. There are too many distractions, and so I talk over the noise to Ryan, but he's more interested in sneaking his hand up my shirt. I've managed to make it 17 years, 8 months, 2 weeks, and 1 day without having sex in the back seat of an Impala. Or anywhere, for that matter. So I tell him I'm dying to see the view, and I push open the door and stand there. We are surrounded by cars and, beyond that, cornfields. There is no view except up. I tilt my head back, suddenly fascinated by the stars. Ryan scrambles after me, and I pretend to know the constellations, pointing them out and making up stories about each one. I wonder what Finch is doing right now. Maybe he's playing guitar somewhere. Maybe he's with a girl. I owe him a wander and, actually, a lot more than that. I don't want him to think I blew him off today because of my so-called friends. I make a note to research where we should go next as soon as I get home. Search terms. Unusual Indiana attractions. Nothing ordinary Indiana. Unique Indiana. Eccentric Indiana. I should also have a copy of the map so I make sure I don't duplicate anything. Ryan puts his arm around me and kisses me, and for a minute, I kiss him. I'm transported back in time, and instead of the Impala, it's Ryan's brother's Jeep. And instead of Romer and Amanda, it's Eli Cross and Eleanor. And we're here at the drive-in seeing a double feature of Die Hard. Then, Ryan's hand is snaking its way up my shirt again, and I pull away. The Impala is back. Romer and Amanda are back. The monster movie is back. I say, I hate to do this, but I have a curfew.
Since when?
Then he seems to remember something.
Sorry, V.
And I know he's thinking it's because of the accident. Ryan offers to walk me home. I tell him, no, I'm good. I got this. But he does it anyway.
I had a great time,
he says on my front step. Me too.
I'll call you.
Great. He leans in to kiss me goodnight, and I turn just slightly so he'll get my cheek instead. He's still standing there as I let myself inside the house.
Finch. Day 15. I am still awake. I go to Violet's early and catch her parents as they're eating breakfast. He is bearded and serious with deep worry lines around his mouth and eyes, and she looks like Violet will look in about 25 years. Dark blonde hair falling in waves, face shaped like a heart, everything etched a little more sharply. Her eyes are warm, but her mouth is sad. They invite me to breakfast, and I ask them about Violet before the accident, since I've only known her after. By the time she comes downstairs, they are remembering the time she and her sister were supposed to go to New York for spring break 2 years ago, but instead decided to follow Boy Parade from Cincinnati to Indianapolis to Chicago to try to get an interview. When Violet sees me, she goes, "Finch?" like I might be a dream, and I say, "Boy Parade?" "Oh my God, why would you tell him that?" I can't help it. I start laughing, and this gets her mom laughing, and then her dad too, until the three of us are laughing like old friends, while Violet stares at us as if we've lost our minds. Afterward, Violet and I stand in front of her house, and because it's her turn to pick the place, she gives me a rough idea of the route and tells me to follow her there. Then she takes off across the lawn and toward her driveway. "I didn't bring my bike." Before she can say anything, I hold up my hand like I'm taking an oath. "I, Theodore Finch, being of unsound mind, hereby swear not to drive faster than 30 miles per hour through town, 50 on the interstate. If at any time you want to stop, we stop. I just ask that you give it a chance." "It's snowing." She's exaggerating. It's barely even coming down. "Not the kind that sticks. Look, we've wandered all we can wander within a reachable by bike radius. We can see a lot more if we drive. I mean, the possibilities are pretty much endless. At least sit inside. Humor me. Sit in there and I'll stand way, way over here, nowhere near the car, so you know I can't ambush you and start driving." She is frozen to the sidewalk. "You can't keep pushing people to do things they don't want to do. You just barge in and help yourself and say, 'We're doing this, we're doing that,' but you don't listen. You don't think about anyone else other than yourself." "Actually, I'm thinking about you holed up in that room of yours, or on that stupid orange bike. Must go here, must go there, here, there, back and forth, but nowhere new or outside those 3 or 4 miles. Maybe I like those 3 or 4 miles. I don't think you do. This morning, your parents painted a pretty good picture of the you you used to be. That other Violet sounds fun and kind of badass, even if she had horrible taste in music. Now all I see is someone who's too afraid to get back out there. Everyone around you is going to give you a gentle push now and then, but never hard enough because they don't want to upset poor Violet. You need shoving, not pushing. You need to jump back on that camel. Otherwise, you're going to stay up on the ledge you've made for yourself." Suddenly, she brushes past me. She climbs into the car and sits looking all around. Even though I tried to clean up a little, the center console is stuffed with pencil stubs and pieces of paper, cigarette butts, a lighter, guitar picks. There's a blanket in the back, and a pillow, and I can tell she's noticed these by the look she gives me. "Oh, relax. The plan is not to seduce you. If it was, you'd know it. Seatbelt." She snaps it into place. "Now, close the door." I stand on the lawn, arms crossed as she pulls the door shut. Then I walk to the driver's side, open the door, and lean in as she's reading the back of a napkin from a place called the Harlem Avenue Lounge. "What do you say, Ultraviolet?" She takes a breath, lets it out. "Okay." I go slow at first, barely 20 miles per hour, as I roll through her neighborhood. We take it block by block. At each stop sign and stoplight, I say, "How are we doing over there?" "Good, just fine." I pull out onto National Road and pick it up to 35. "How's this?" "Great." "How about now?" "Stop asking me." We go so slow that cars and trucks are speeding past and honking. One guy yells at us out his window and flips us off. It's taking all I have not to slam my foot against the gas pedal, but then I'm used to slowing down so that everyone else can catch up. To distract myself and her, I talk to her like we're on the bell tower ledge. "My whole life I've run either 3 times faster than everyone else, or 3 times slower. When I was little, I used to race in circles around the living room over and over, until I wore this ring into the carpet. It got so I started following the ring, until my dad tore up the rug himself, just ripped it right out with his bare hands. Instead of replacing the carpet, he left the concrete exposed, so there were these little patches of glue everywhere, with bits of rug stuck to it. So do it. Go fast." "Oh no, 40 all the way, baby." But I bring it up to 50. Right about now, I'm feeling pretty damn good because I got Violet into the car, and my dad is headed out of town on business, which means no obligatory family dinner tonight. "Your parents are awesome, by the way." "You lucked out in the parental lottery, Ultraviolet." "Thanks." "So, boy parade. Did you ever get that interview?" She gives me a look. "Okay, tell me about the accident." I don't expect her to, but she gazes out the window, then starts talking. "I don't remember much of it. I remember getting in the car as we were leaving the party. She and Eli had a fight." "Eli Cross?" "They'd been going out for most of last year. She was upset, but she wouldn't let me drive. I was the one who told her to take the A Street Bridge." She goes very, very quiet. "I remember the sign that said, 'Bridge ices before road.' I remember sliding, and Eleanor saying, 'I can't hold on.' I remember the air as we went through it, and Eleanor screaming. After that, everything went black. I woke up 3 hours later in the hospital." "Tell me about her." She stares out the window. "She was smart, stubborn, moody, funny, mean when she lost her temper, sweet, protective of the people she loved. Her favorite color was yellow. She always had my back, even if we fought sometimes. I could tell her anything because the thing about Eleanor was that she didn't judge. She was my best friend." "I've never had one. What's it like?" "I don't know. I guess you can be yourself, whatever that means. The best and the worst of you. And they love you anyway. You can fight, but even when you're mad at them, you know they're not going to stop being your friend. I might need to get one of those. Listen, I wanted to say I'm sorry about Romer and those guys." The speed limit is 70, but I make myself stay at 60. "It's not your fault. and sorry wastes time. You have to live your life like you'll never be sorry. It's easier just to do the right thing from the start, so there's nothing to apologize for. Not that I'm one to talk. The bookmobile park is just outside Bartlett on a country road lined with cornfields. Because the earth is flat and there are hardly any trees, the trailers rise out of the landscape like skyscrapers. I lean forward over the wheel. What the hell? Violet is leaning forward too, hands on the dashboard. As I turn off the pavement onto gravel, she says, "We used to do this thing in California, where sometimes my parents and Eleanor and I would get in the car and go on a bookstore hunt. We each chose a book we wanted to find, and we couldn't go home till we'd found copies of all of them. We might hit up 8 or 10 stores in a day." She's out of the car before I am, and heading toward the first bookmobile, an Airstream trailer from the 1950s, which is across the gravel and across the field. There are 7 trailers in all, different makes and models and years, and they sit in a line with the corn growing up around them. Each one advertises a specific category of books. This is one of the coolest fucking things I've ever seen. I don't know if Violet even hears me because she's already climbing up into the first trailer. "Watch that mouth, young man." A hand is being extended, and now I'm shaking that hand, and it belongs to a short, round woman with bleached yellow hair, warm eyes, and a crinkled-up face. Faye Carnes. "Theodore Finch, are you the mastermind behind this?" I nod at the line of bookmobiles. "I am." She walks, and I follow. "The county discontinued bookmobile service in the 80s. And I told my husband, now that's a shame, I mean a true blue shame. What's going to happen to those trailers? Someone ought to buy them and keep them going." So we did. At first we drove them around town ourselves, but my husband, Franklin, he's got a bad back, so we decided to plant them, just like corn, and let folks come to us. Mrs. Carnes leads me from trailer to trailer, and at each one I go up and in and explore. I pick through stacks of hardcovers and paperbacks, all of them well used and well read. I'm looking for something in particular, but so far I don't see it. Mrs. Carnes follows along, straightening the books, dusting off the shelves, and tells me about husband Franklin and daughter Sarah and son Franklin Jr., who made the mistake of marrying a girl from Kentucky, which means they never see him except at Christmas. She's a talker, but I like her. Violet finds us in trailer 6, children's, her arms full of classics. She says hello to Mrs. Carnes and asks, "How does this work? Do I need my library card?" "You got the choice of buying or borrowing, but either way you don't need a card. If you borrow, we trust you to bring them back. If you buy, we only take cash." "I'd like to buy." Violet nods at me. "Can you reach the money in my bag?" Instead, I pull out my wallet and hand Mrs. Carnes a 20, which is the smallest I have, and she counts off the books. "That's $1 a book, times 10. I'm going to have to go up to the house to get change." She's gone before I can tell her to keep the money. Violet sets the books down, and now I go with her to explore each trailer. We add a few more books to the pile, and at some point I catch her eye, and she's smiling at me. It's the kind of smile you smile when you're thinking someone over and trying to decide how you feel about them. I smile at her, and she looks away. Then Mrs. Carnes is back, and we argue about the change. I want her to keep it, she wants me to keep it, and finally I do, because she absolutely won't take no. I jog the books to the car while she talks to Violet. In my wallet I find one more 20, and when I get back to the trailers, I duck into the first one and drop the 20 and the change into the old register that sits on a kind of makeshift counter. A group of kids arrives, and we tell Mrs. Carnes goodbye. As we walk away, Violet says, "That was awesome." It was, but it doesn't count as a wandering. It's technically one more place, and that's all we needed. Sorry, awesome as it is, it's practically in our backyard, in the middle of your 3 to 4 mile safe zone. Besides, it's not about crossing things off a list. She is now walking several feet ahead, pretending I don't exist. But that's okay, I'm used to it. And what she doesn't know is that it doesn't faze me. People either see me or they don't. I wonder what it's like to walk down the street, safe and easy in your skin, and just blend right in. No one turning away, no one staring, no one waiting and expecting, wondering what stupid, crazy thing you'll do next. Then I can't hold back anymore, and I take off running, and it feels good to break free from the slow, regular pace of everyone else. I break free from my mind, which is, for some reason, picturing myself as dead as the authors of the books Violet collected, asleep for good this time, buried deep in the ground under layers and layers of dirt and cornfields. I can almost feel the earth closing in, the air going stale and damp, the dark pressing down on top of me, and I have to open my mouth to breathe. In a blur, Violet passes me, hair sailing behind her like a kite, the sun catching it and turning it gold at the ends. I'm so deep in my own head, accepting the thoughts, letting them come, that at first I'm not sure it's her, and then I sprint to catch up and run along beside her, matching my pace to hers. She's off again, and we push ourselves so hard and fast, I expect to go flying off the earth. This is my secret, that any moment I might fly away. Everyone on earth but me, and now Violet, moves in slow motion, like they're filled with mud. We are faster than all of them. And then we're at the car, and Violet is giving me a, "So there, take that," look. I tell myself I let her win, but she's beat me fair and square. After we're in and the engine is running, I toss her our notebook, the one we're using to record our wanderings, and say, "Write it all down before we forget anything." "I thought this one didn't count." But she's flipping through the pages. "Humor me. Oh, and we're hitting one more place on the way home." We've left the gravel and are cruising along on pavement again when she looks up from the notebook she's now writing in. "I was so busy with the books, I forgot to leave something behind." "It's okay. I did."
Violet. 145 days till liberation. He misses the turnoff, goes right over the grassy center to the other side, and climbs back onto the interstate, heading in the opposite direction. At some point, we exit onto a quiet country road. We take this for a mile or so, and Finch has turned up the music and is singing along. He drums the beat on the steering wheel, and then we turn into this little town that is just a couple blocks long. Finch hunches over the dash and slows down to a crawl.
"Do you see any street signs?"
"That one says church."
"Good. Brilliant."
He turns, and just a block later pulls over to the curb and parks.
"We're here."
He's out of the car and at my door, opening it, offering his hand. We're walking toward this big old factory building that looks abandoned. I can see something along the wall, stretching for the entire length of it. Finch keeps going and comes to a sudden stop at the far end. "Before I die," it says on what looks like a giant chalkboard. And there below these giant white letters are column after column, line after line that say, "Before I die."